Gale's knife slit his throat before he knew what had happened. Momentarily, I felt a pang at killing something so fresh and innocent, and then my stomach rumbled at the thought of all that fresh and innocent meat. A deer! Gale and I have only brought down 3 in all. The first one, a doe, that had injured her leg somehow, almost didn't count. But we knew from that experience not to go dragging the carcass into the hob. It had caused chaos with people bidding on parts and actually trying to hack off pieces themselves. Greasy Say had intervened and sent us with our deer to the butcher, but not before it'd been badly damaged, hunks of meat taken, the hide riddled with holes. Although everybody paid up fairly, it had lowered the value of the kill. This time, we waited until dark fell and slipped under a hole in the fence close to the butcher. Even though we were known hunters, it wouldn't have been good to go carrying a 150-pound deer through the streets of District 12 in daylight, like we were rubbing it in the officials' faces. The butcher, a short, chunky woman named Ruba, came to the back door when we knocked. You don't haggle with Ruba. She gives you one price, which you can take or leave, but it's a fair price. We took her offer on the deer, and she threw in a couple of venison steaks we could pick up after the butchering. Even with the money divided in two, neither Gale nor I had held so much at one time in our lives. We decided to keep it a secret and surprise our families with the meat and money at the end of the next day. This is where I really got the money for the goat. But I tell Peter, I sold an old silver locket of my mother's. That can't hurt anyone. Then I pick up the story in the late afternoon of Prim's birthday. Gale and I went to the market on the square so that I could buy dress materials. As I was running my fingers over a length of thick blue cotton cloth, something caught my eye. There's an old man who keeps a small herd of goats on the other side of the seam. I don't know his real name. Everyone just calls him the Goat Man. His joints are swollen and twisted in painful angles, and he's got a hacking cough that proves he spent years in the mines. But he's lucky. Somewhere along the way he saved up enough for these goats and now has something to do in his old age besides slowly starve to death. He's filthy and impatient, but the goats are clean and their milk is rich if you can afford it. One of the goats, a white one with black patches, was lying down in a cart. It was easy to see why. Something, probably a dog, had mauled her shoulder and infection had set in. It was bad. The goat man had to hold her up to milk her. But I thought I knew someone who could fix it. Gale, I whispered. I want that goat for Prim. Owning a nanny goat can change your life in District 12. The animals can live off almost anything. The meadow's a perfect feeding place, and they can give 4 quarts of milk a day to drink, to make into cheese, to sell. It's not even against the law.
She's hurt pretty bad, said Gale. We better take a closer look.
We went over and bought a cup of milk to share, then stood over the goat as if idly curious.
Let her be, said the man.
Just looking, said Gale.
Well, look fast. She goes to the butcher soon. Hardly anyone will buy her milk, and then they only pay half price, said the man.
What's the butcher giving for her? I asked.
The man shrugged. Hang around and see.
I turned and saw Ruba coming across the square toward us.
Lucky thing you showed up, said the goat man when she arrived. Girl's got her eye on your goat.
Not if she's spoken for, I said carelessly. Ruba looked me up and down, then frowned at the goat.
She's not. Look at that shoulder. Bet you half the carcass will be too rotten for even sausage.
What?
Said the goat man.
We had a deal.
We had a deal for an animal with a few teeth marks. Not that thing. Sell her to the girl, if she's stupid enough to take her, said Ruba. As she marched off, I caught her wink. The goat man was mad,
but he still wanted that goat off his hands. It took us half an hour to agree on the price. Quite a crowd had gathered by then to hand out opinions. It was an excellent deal if the goat lived. I'd been robbed if she died. People took sides in the argument, but I took the goat. Gale offered to carry her. I think he wanted to see the look on Prim's face as much as I did. In a moment of complete giddiness, I bought a pink ribbon and tied it around her neck. Then we hurried back to my house. You should have seen Prim's reaction when we walked in with that goat. Remember, this is a girl who wept to save that awful old cat, Buttercup. She was so excited, she started crying and laughing all at once. My mother was less sure, seeing the injury, but the pair of them went to work on it, grinding up herbs and coaxing brews down the animal's throat.
They sound like you, says Peeta.
I had almost forgotten he was there. Oh, no, Peeta. They work magic. That thing couldn't have died if it tried, I say. But then I bite my tongue, realizing what that must sound like to Peeta, who is dying, in my incompetent hands.
Don't worry. I'm not trying, he jokes. Finish the story.
Well, that's it. Only I remember that night. Prim insisted on sleeping with Lady on a blanket next to the fire, and just before they drifted off, the goat licked her cheek, like it was giving her a goodnight kiss or something, I say. It was already mad about her.
Was it still wearing the pink ribbon? He asks.
I think so, I say. Why?
I'm just trying to get a picture,
he says thoughtfully.
I can see why that day made you happy.
Well, I knew that goat would be a little gold mine, I say.
Yes, of course. I was referring to that. Not the lasting joy you gave the sister you love so much. You took her place in the reaping, says Peeta dryly.
The goat has paid for itself several times over, I say in a superior tone.
Well, it wouldn't dare do anything else after you saved its life, says Peeta. I intend to do the same thing.
Really? What did you cost me again? I ask.
A lot of trouble. Don't worry. You'll get it all back, he says.
You're not making sense, I say. I test his forehead. The fever's going nowhere but up. You're a little cooler, though. The sound of the trumpets startles me. I'm on my feet and at the mouth of the cave in a flash, not wanting to miss a syllable. It's my new best friend, Claudius Templesmith, and, as I expected, he's inviting us to a feast. Well, we're not that hungry, and I actually wave his offer away in indifference when he says,
"Now hold on. Some of you may already be declining my invitation. But this is no ordinary feast. Each of you needs something desperately."
I do need something desperately, something to heal Peeta's leg.
"Each of you will find that something in a backpack marked with your district number at the cornucopia at dawn. Think hard about refusing to show up. For some of you, this will be your last chance," says Claudius.
There's nothing else, just his words, hanging in the air. I jump as Peeta grips my shoulder from behind.
"No,"
he says.
"You're not risking your life for me."
"Who said I was?" I say.
"So you're not going?" he asks.
"Of course I'm not going. Give me some credit. Do you think I'm running straight into some free-for-all against Cato and Clove and Thresh? Don't be stupid," I say, helping him back to bed. "I'll let them fight it out. We'll see who's in the sky tomorrow night and work out a plan from there."
"You're such a bad liar, Katniss. I don't know how you've survived this long."
He begins to mimic me.
"I knew that goat would be a little gold mine. You're a little cooler, though. Of course I'm not going,"
He shakes his head.
Never gamble at cards. You'll lose your last coin, he says.
Anger flushes my face. All right, I am going, and you can't stop me.
I can follow you, at least part way. I may not make it to the cornucopia, but if I'm yelling your name, I bet someone can find me, and then I'll be dead for sure, he says.
You won't get 100 yards from here on that leg, I say.
Then I'll drag myself, says Peeta. You go, and I'm going too.
He's just stubborn enough, and maybe just strong enough to do it. Come howling after me in the woods. Even if a tribute doesn't find him, something else might. He can't defend himself. I'd probably have to wall him up in the cave just to go myself. And who knows what the exertion will do to him. What am I supposed to do? Sit here and watch you die? I say. He must know that's not an option, that the audience would hate me. And frankly, I would hate myself too, if I didn't even try.
I won't die, I promise, if you promise not to go, he says.
We're at something of a stalemate. I know I can't argue him out of this one, so I don't try. I pretend, reluctantly, to go along. Then you have to do what I say. Drink your water, wake me when I tell you, and eat every bite of the soup, no matter how disgusting it is. I snap at him.
Agreed. Is it ready?
He asks. Wait here, I say. The air's gone cold, even though the sun's still up. I'm right about the game makers messing with the temperature. I wonder if the thing someone needs desperately is a good blanket. The soup is still nice and warm in its iron pot, and actually doesn't taste too bad. Peeta eats without complaint, even scraping out the pot to show his enthusiasm. He rambles on about how delicious it is, which should be encouraging if you don't know what fever does to people. He's like listening to Haymitch before the alcohol has soaked him into incoherence. I give him another dose of fever medicine before he goes off his head completely. As I go down to the stream to wash up, all I can think is that he's going to die if I don't get to that feast. I'll keep him going for a day or two, and then the infection will reach his heart or his brain or his lungs, and he'll be gone. And I'll be here all alone, again, waiting for the others. I'm so lost in thought that I almost miss the parachute, even though it floats right by me. Then I spring after it, yanking it from the water, tearing off the silver fabric to retrieve the vial. Haymitch has done it. He's gotten the medicine. I don't know how, persuaded some gaggle of romantic fools to sell their jewels. And I can save Peeta. It's such a tiny vial, though. It must be very strong to cure someone as ill as Peeta. A ripple of doubt runs through me. I uncork the vial and take a deep sniff. My spirits fall at the sickly sweet scent. Just to be sure, I place a drop on the tip of my tongue. There's no question. It's sleep syrup. It's a common medicine in District 12, cheap as medicine goes, but very addictive. Almost everyone's had a dose at one time or another. We have some in a bottle at home. My mother gives it to hysterical patients to knock them out to stitch up a bad wound or quiet their minds or just to help someone in pain get through the night. It only takes a little. A vial this size could knock Peeta out for a full day, but what good is that? I'm so furious, I'm about to throw Haymitch's last offering into the stream when it hits me. A full day? That's more than I need. I mash up a handful of berries so the taste won't be as noticeable and add some mint leaves for good measure. Then I head back to the cave. I've brought you a treat. I found a new patch of berries a little farther downstream. Peeta opens his mouth for the first bite without hesitation. He swallows, then frowns slightly.
They're very sweet.
Yes, they're sugar berries, My mother makes jam from them. Haven't you ever had them before? I say, poking the next spoonful in his mouth.
No,
he says, almost puzzled.
But they taste familiar.
Sugar berries? Well, you can't get them in the market much. They only grow wild. I say, another mouthful goes down. Just one more to go.
They're sweet as syrup,
he says, taking the last spoonful.
Syrup.
His eyes widen as he realizes the truth. I clamp my hand over his mouth and nose hard, forcing him to swallow instead of spit. He tries to make himself vomit the stuff up, but it's too late. He's already losing consciousness. Even as he fades away, I can see in his eyes what I've done is unforgivable. I sit back on my heels and look at him with a mixture of sadness and satisfaction. A stray berry stains his chin, and I wipe it away.
Who can't lie, Peeta?
I say, even though he can't hear me. It doesn't matter. The rest of Panem can. Chapter 21. In the remaining hours before nightfall, I gather rocks and do my best to camouflage the opening of the cave. It's a slow and arduous process, but after a lot of sweating and shifting things around, I'm pretty pleased with my work. The cave now appears to be part of a larger pile of rocks, like so many in the vicinity. I can still crawl in to Peeta through a small opening, but it's undetectable from the outside. That's good, because I'll need to share that sleeping bag again tonight. Also, if I don't make it back from the feast, Peeta will be hidden but not entirely imprisoned. Although I doubt he can hang on much longer without medicine. If I die at the feast, District 12 isn't likely to have a victor. I make a meal out of the smaller, bonier fish that inhabit the stream down here, fill every water container, and purify it, and clean my weapons. I've 9 arrows left in all. I debate leaving the knife with Peeta, so he'll have some protection while I'm gone. But there's really no point. He was right about camouflage being his final defense. But I still might have use for the knife. Who knows what I'll encounter? Here are some things I'm fairly certain of. That at least Cato, Clove, and Thresh will be on hand when the feast starts. I'm not sure about Foxface, since direct confrontation isn't her style or her forte. She's even smaller than I am and unarmed, unless she's picked up some weapons recently. She'll probably be hanging somewhere nearby, seeing what she can scavenge. But the other 3, I'm going to have my hands full. My ability to kill at a distance is my greatest asset, but I know I'll have to go right into the thick of things to get that backpack, the one with the number 12 on it that Claudius Templesmith mentioned. I watch the sky, hoping for one less opponent at dawn. But nobody appears tonight. Tomorrow there will be faces up there. Feasts always result in fatalities. I crawl into the cave, secure my glasses, and curl up next to Peeta. Luckily, I had that good long sleep today. I have to stay awake. I don't really think anyone will attack our cave tonight, but I can't risk missing the dawn. So cold, so bitterly cold tonight, as if the game makers have sent an infusion of frozen air across the arena, which may be exactly what they've done. I lay next to Peeta in the bag, trying to absorb every bit of his fever heat. It's strange to be so physically close to someone who's so distant. Peeta might as well be back in the capital, or in District 12, or on the moon right now. He'd be no harder to reach. I've never felt lonelier since the games began. Just accept it will be a bad night, I tell myself. I try not to, but I can't help thinking of my mother and Prim, wondering if they'll sleep a wink tonight. At this late stage in the games, with an important event like the feast, school will probably be cancelled, My family can either watch on the static-filled old clunker of a television at home, or join the crowds in the square to watch on the big, clear screens. They'll have privacy at home, but support in the square. People will give them a kind word, a bit of food if they can spare it. I wonder if the baker has sought them out, especially now that Peter and I are a team, and made good on his promise to keep my sister's belly full. Spirits must be running high in District 12. We so rarely have anyone to root for at this point in the games. Surely people are excited about Peter and me, especially now that we're together. If I close my eyes, I can imagine their shouts at the screens, urging us on. I see their faces, Greasy Say and Madge and even the peacekeepers who buy my meat, cheering for us. And Gale, I know him. He won't be shouting and cheering, but he'll be watching every moment, every twist and turn, and willing me to come home. I wonder if he's hoping that Peter makes it as well. Gale's not my boyfriend, but would he be if I opened that door? He talked about us running away together. Was that just a practical calculation of our chances of survival away from the district, or something more? I wonder what he makes of all this kissing. Through a crack in the rocks, I watch the moon cross the sky. At what I judge to be about 3 hours before dawn, I begin final preparations. I'm careful to leave Peter with water and the medical kit right beside him. Nothing else will be of much use if I don't return, and even these would only prolong his life a short time. After some debate, I strip him of his jacket and zip it on over my own. He doesn't need it. Not now, in the sleeping bag with his fever. And during the day, if I'm not there to remove it, he'll be roasting in it. My hands are already stiff from cold, so I take Rue's spare pair of socks, cut holes for my fingers and thumbs, and pull them on. It helps, anyway. I fill her small pack with some food, a water bottle, and bandages, tuck the knife in my belt, get my bow and arrows. I'm about to leave when I remember the importance of sustaining the star-crossed lover routine, and I lean over and give Peter a long, lingering kiss. I imagine the teary sighs emanating from the capital, and pretend to brush away a tear of my own. Then I squeeze through the opening in the rocks out into the night. My breath makes small white clouds as it hits the air. It's as cold as a November night at home, one where I've slipped into the woods, lantern in hand, to join Gale at some prearranged place, where we'll sit bundled together, sipping herb tea from metal flasks wrapped in quilting, hoping game will pass our way as the morning comes on. Oh, Gale, I think, if only you had my back now. I move as fast as I dare. The glasses are quite remarkable, but I still sorely miss having the use of my left ear. I don't know what the explosion did, but it damaged something deep and irreparable. Never mind. If I get home, I'll be so stinking rich I'll be able to pay someone to do my hearing. The woods always look different at night. Even with the glasses, everything has an unfamiliar slant to it, as if the daytime trees and flowers and stones had gone to bed and sent slightly more ominous versions of themselves to take their places. I don't try anything tricky, like taking a new route. I make my way back up the stream and follow the same path back to Rue's hiding place near the lake. Along the way, I see no sign of another tribute, not a puff of breath, not a quiver of a branch. Either I'm the first to arrive, or the others positioned themselves last night. There's still more than an hour, maybe two, when I wriggle into the underbrush and wait for the blood to begin to flow. I chew a few mint leaves. My stomach isn't up for much more. Thank goodness I have Peter's jacket as well as my own. If not, I'd be forced to move around to stay warm. The sky turns a misty morning gray, and still there's no sign of the other tributes. It's not surprising, really, Everyone has distinguished themselves either by strength or deadliness or cunning. Do they suppose, I wonder, that I have Peeta with me? I doubt Foxface and Thresh, even though he was wounded. All the better if they think he's covering me when I go in for the backpack. But where is it? The arena has lightened enough for me to remove my glasses. I can hear the morning birds singing. Isn't it time? For a second, I'm panicked that I'm at the wrong location. But no, I'm certain I remember Claudius Templesmith specifying the cornucopia. And there it is, and here I am. So where's my feast? Just as the first ray of sun glints off the gold cornucopia, there's a disturbance on the plain. The ground before the mouth of the horn splits in two, and a round table with a snowy white cloth rises into the arena. On the table sit four backpacks, two large black ones with the numbers 2 and 11, a medium-sized green one with the number 5, and a tiny orange one. Really, I could carry it around my wrist. That must be marked with a 12. The table has just clicked into place when a figure darts out of the cornucopia, snags the green backpack, and speeds off. Foxface! Leave it to her to come up with such a clever and risky idea. The rest of us are still poised around the plane, sizing up the situation, and she's got hers. She's got us trapped, too, because no one wants to chase her down, not while their own packs sit so vulnerable on the table. Foxface must have purposefully left the other packs alone, knowing that to steal one without her number would definitely bring on a pursuer. That should have been my strategy. By the time I've worked through the emotions of surprise, admiration, anger, jealousy, and frustration, I'm watching that reddish mane of hair disappear into the trees well out of shooting range. Huh. I'm always dreading the others, but maybe Foxface is the real opponent here. She's cost me time, too, because by now it's clear that I must get to the table next. Anyone who beats me to it will easily scoop up my pack and be gone. Without hesitation, I sprint for the table. I can sense the emergence of danger before I see it. Fortunately, the first knife comes whizzing in on my right side so I can hear it, and I'm able to deflect it with my bow. I turn, drawing back the bowstring, and send an arrow straight at Clove's heart. She turns just enough to avoid a fatal hit, but the point punctures her upper left arm. Unfortunately, she throws with her right, but it's enough to slow her down a few moments, having to pull the arrow from her arm, take in the severity of the wound. I keep moving, positioning the next arrow automatically, as only someone who has hunted for years can do. I'm at the table now, my fingers closing over the tiny orange backpack. My hand slips between the straps, and I yank it up on my arm. It's really too small to fit on any other part of my anatomy, and I'm turning to fire again when the second knife catches me in the forehead. It slices above my right eyebrow, opening a gash that sends a gush running down my face, blinding my eye, filling my mouth with the sharp metallic taste of my own blood. I stagger backward, but still manage to send my readied arrow in the general direction of my assailant. I know as it leaves my hands it will miss, and then Clove slams into me, knocking me flat on my back, pinning my shoulders to the ground with her knees. This is it, I think, and hope for Prim's sake it will be fast. But Clove means to savor the moment, even feels she has time. No doubt Cato is somewhere nearby, guarding her, waiting for Thresh and possibly Peeta. "Where's your boyfriend, District 12, still hanging on?" she asks. "Well, as long as we're talking, I'm alive." "He's out there now, hunting Cato," I snarl at her. Then I scream at the top of my lungs, "Peeta!" Clove jams her fist into my windpipe, very effectively cutting off my voice. But her head's whipping from side to side, and I know for a moment she's at least considering I'm telling the truth. Since no Peter appears to save me, she turns back to me.
Liar, she says with a grin. He's nearly dead. Cato knows where he cut him. You've probably got him strapped up in some tree while you try to keep his heart going. What's in the pretty little backpack? That medicine for lover boy? Too bad he'll never get it.
Clove opens her jacket. It's lined with an impressive array of knives. She carefully selects an almost dainty-looking number with a cruel, curved blade.
I promised Cato, if he let me have you, I'd give the audience a good show.
I'm struggling now in an effort to unseat her, but it's no use. She's too heavy, and her lock on me too tight.
Forget it, District 12. We're going to kill you. Just like we did your pathetic little ally. What was her name? The one who hopped around in the trees. Rue? Well, first Rue, then you. And then I think we'll just let nature take care of Lover Boy. How does that sound? Clove asks. Now, where to start?
She carelessly wipes away the blood from my wound with her jacket sleeve. For a moment, she surveys my face, tilting it from side to side, as if it's a block of wood and she's deciding exactly what pattern to carve on it. I attempt to bite her hand, but she grabs the hair on the top of my head, forcing me back to the ground.
I think, she almost purrs, I think we'll start with your mouth.
I clamp my teeth together as she teasingly traces the outline of my lips with the tip of the blade. I won't close my eyes. The comment about Rue has filled me with fury, enough fury, I think, to die with some dignity. As my last act of defiance, I will stare her down as long as I can see, which will probably not be an extended period of time, but I will stare her down. I will not cry out. I will die, in my own small way, undefeated.
Yes, I don't think you'll have much use for your lips anymore. Wanna blow Lover Boy one last kiss? She asks.
I work up a mouthful of blood and saliva and spit it in her face. She flushes with rage.
All right, then. Let's get started.
I brace myself for the agony that's sure to follow. But as I feel the tip open the first cut at my lip, some great force yanks Clove from my body, and then she's screaming. I'm too stunned at first, too unable to process what has happened. Has Peter somehow come to my rescue? Have the game maker sent in some wild animal to add to the fun? Has a hovercraft inexplicably plucked her into the air? But when I push myself up on my numb arms, I see it's none of the above. Clove is dangling a foot off the ground, imprisoned in Thresh's arms. I let out a gasp, seeing him like that, towering over me, holding Clove like a rag doll. I remember him as big, but he seems more massive, more powerful than I even recall. If anything, he seems to have gained weight in the arena. He flips Clove around and flings her onto the ground. When he shouts, I jump, never having heard him speak above a mutter.
What'd you do to that little girl? You kill her?
Clove is scrambling backward on all fours, like a frantic insect, too shocked to even call for Cato.
No, no, it wasn't me.
You said her name. I heard you. You kill her?
Another thought brings a fresh wave of rage to his features.
You cut her up like you were going to cut up this girl here?
No, no, I...
Clove sees the stone, about the size of a small loaf of bread in Thresh's hand, and loses it.
Cato!
She screeches,
Cato!
Clove!
I hear Cato's answer, but he's too far away. I can tell that much to do her any good. What was he doing? Trying to get Foxface or Peeta? Or had he been lying in wait for Thresh and just badly misjudged his location? Thresh brings the rock down hard against Clove's temple. It's not bleeding, but I can see the dent in her skull, and I know that she's a goner. There's still life in her now, though, in the rapid rise and fall of her chest, the low moan escaping her lips. When Thresh whirls around on me, the rock raised, I know it's no good to run. And my bow is empty, the last loaded arrow having gone in Clove's direction. I'm trapped in the glare of his strange golden brown eyes.
What'd she mean? About Rue being your ally?
We teamed up. Blew up the supplies. I tried to save her. I did. But he got there first. District 1, I say. Maybe if he knows I helped Rue, he won't choose some slow, sadistic end for me.
And you killed him?
He demands. Yes, I killed him. And buried her in flowers, I say. And I sang her to sleep. Tears spring in my eyes. The tension, the fight goes out of me at the memory. And I'm overwhelmed by Rue, and the pain in my head, and my fear of Thresh, and the moaning of the dying girl a few feet away.
To sleep?
Thresh says gruffly. To death. I sang until she died, I say. Your district. They sent me bread. My hand reaches up, but not for an arrow that I know I'll never reach, just to wipe my nose. Do it fast, okay, Thresh? Conflicting emotions cross Thresh's face. He lowers the rock and points at me. Almost accusingly.
Just this one time, I let you go, for the little girl. You and me, we're even then. No more owed. You understand?
I nod, because I do understand, about owing, about hating it. I understand that if Thresh wins, he'll have to go back and face a district that has already broken all the rules to thank me. And he is breaking the rules to thank me, too. And I understand that, for the moment, Thresh is not going to smash in my skull.
Clove!
Cato's voice is much nearer now. I can tell by the pain in it that he sees her on the ground.
You better run now, Fire Girl,
says Thresh. I don't need to be told twice. I flip over, and my feet dig into the hard-packed earth. As I run away from Thresh and Clove and the sound of Cato's voice. Only when I reach the woods do I turn back for an instant. Thresh and both large backpacks are vanishing over the edge of the plain into the area I've never seen. Cato kneels beside Clove, spear in hand, begging her to stay with him. In a moment, he will realize it's futile. She can't be saved. I crash into the trees, repeatedly wiping away the blood that's pouring into my eye, fleeing like the wild, wounded creature I am. After a few minutes, I hear the cannon, and I know that Clove has died, that Cato will be on one of our trails, either Thresh's or mine. I'm seized with terror, weak from my head wound, shaking. I load an arrow, but Cato can throw that spear almost as far as I can shoot. Only one thing calms me down. Thresh has Cato's backpack, containing the thing he needs desperately. If I had to bet, Cato headed out after Thresh, not me. Still, I don't slow down when I reach the water. I plunge right in, boots still on, and flounder downstream. I pull off Rue's socks that I've been using for gloves, and press them into my forehead, trying to staunch the flow of blood. But they're soaked in minutes. Somehow, I make it back to the cave. I squeeze through the rocks. In the dappled light, I pull the little orange backpack from my arm, cut open the clasp, and dump the contents on the ground. One slim box containing one hypodermic needle. Without hesitating, I jam the needle into Peter's arm and slowly press down on the plunger. My hands go to my head, and then drop to my lap, slick with blood. The last thing I remember is an exquisitely beautiful green and silver moth landing on the curve of my wrist.
Chapter 22. The sound of rain drumming on the roof of our house gently pulls me toward consciousness. I fight to return to sleep, though, wrapped in a warm cocoon of blankets, safe at home. I'm vaguely aware that my head aches. Possibly I have the flu, and this is why I'm allowed to stay in bed, even though I can tell I've been asleep a long time. My mother's hand strokes my cheek, and I don't push it away as I would in wakefulness, never wanting her to know how much I crave that gentle touch, how much I miss her, even though I still don't trust her. Then there's a voice, the wrong voice, not my mother's, and I'm scared.
Katniss, it says. Katniss, can you hear me?
My eyes open, and the sense of security vanishes. I'm not home, not with my mother. I'm in a dim, chilly cave, my bare feet freezing despite the cover, the air tainted with the unmistakable smell of blood. The haggard, pale face of a boy slides into view, and after an initial jolt of alarm, I feel better.
Peter. Hey, he says. Good to see your eyes again.
How long have I been out? I ask.
Not sure. I woke up yesterday evening and you were lying next to me in a very scary pool of blood, he says. I think it stopped finally, but I wouldn't sit up or anything.
I gingerly lift my hand to my head and find it bandaged. This simple gesture leaves me weak and dizzy. Peter holds a bottle to my lips, and I drink thirstily.
You're better, I say. Much better. Whatever you shot into my arm did the trick, he says. By this morning, almost all the swelling in my leg was gone.
He doesn't seem angry about my tricking him, drugging him, and running off to the feast. Maybe I'm just too beat up, and I'll hear about it later when I'm stronger, but for the moment, he's all gentleness.
Did you eat?
I ask.
I'm sorry to say, I gobbled down 3 pieces of that grusling before I realized it might have to last a while. Don't worry, I'm back on a strict diet, he says.
No, it's good. You need to eat. I'll go hunting soon, I say.
Not too soon, all right? He says. You just let me take care of you for a while.
I don't really seem to have much choice. Peter feeds me bites of grusling and raisins and makes me drink plenty of water. He rubs some warmth back into my feet and wraps them in his jacket before tucking the sleeping bag back up around my chin.
Your boots and socks are still damp, and the weather's not helping much, he says.
There's a clap of thunder, and I see lightning electrify the sky through an opening in the rocks. Rain drips through several holes in the ceiling, but Peter has built a sort of canopy over my head and upper body by wedging the square of plastic into the rocks above me.
I wonder what brought on this storm. I mean, who's the target? Says Peter.
Cato and Thresh, I say without thinking.
Foxface will be in her den somewhere. And Clove, she cut me and then...
My voice trails off.
I know, Clove's dead. I saw it in the sky last night, he says. Did you kill her?
No. Thresh broke her skull with a rock, I say.
Lucky he didn't catch you, too, says Peter.
The memory of the feast returns full force, and I feel sick.
He did. But he let me go.
Then, of course, I have to tell him about things I've kept to myself because he was too sick to ask, and I wasn't ready to relive anyway. like the explosion and my ear, and Rue's dying, and the boy from District 1, and the bread. All of which leads to what happened with Thresh, and how he was paying off a debt of sorts.
He let you go because he didn't want to owe you anything?
Asks Peeta in disbelief. Yes. I don't expect you to understand it. You've always had enough. But if you'd lived in the seam, I wouldn't have to explain, I say.
And don't try. Obviously I'm too dim to get it, he says.
It's like the bread. How I never seem to get over owing you for that, I say.
The bread? What, from when we were kids?
He says.
I think we can let that go. I mean, you just brought me back from the dead.
But you didn't know me. We had never even spoken. Besides, it's the first gift that's always the hardest to pay back. I wouldn't have even been here to do it if you hadn't helped me then, I say.
Why did you, anyway? Why? You know why, Peeta says.
I give my head a slight painful shake.
Haymitch said you would take a lot of convincing.
Haymitch, I ask. What's he got to do with it?
Nothing, Peeta says.
So, Cato and Thresh, huh? I guess it's too much to hope that they'll simultaneously destroy each other.
But the thought only upsets me. I think we would like Thresh. I think he'd be our friend back in District 12, I say.
Then let's hope Cato kills him, so we don't have to, says Peeta grimly.
I don't want Cato to kill Thresh at all. I don't want anyone else to die. But this is absolutely not the kind of thing that victors go around saying in the arena. Despite my best efforts, I can feel tears starting to pool in my eyes. Peeta looks at me in concern.
What is it? Are you in a lot of pain?
I give him another answer, because it is equally true, but can be taken as a brief moment of weakness instead of a terminal one.
I want to go home, Peeta,
I say plaintively, like a small child.
You will, I promise,
he says, and bends over to give me a kiss.
I want to go home now, I say. Tell you what, you go back to sleep and dream of home, and you'll be there for real before you know it, he says. Okay?
Okay, I whisper. Wake me if you need me to keep watch.
I'm good and rested, thanks to you and Haymitch. Besides, who knows how long this will last, he says.
What does he mean? The storm? The brief respite it brings us? The games themselves? I don't know, but I'm too sad and tired to ask. It's evening when Peeta wakes me again. The rain has turned to a downpour, sending streams of water through our ceiling, where earlier there had been only drips. Peeta has placed the broth pot under the worst one and repositioned the plastic to deflect most of it from me. I feel a bit better, able to sit up without getting too dizzy, and I'm absolutely famished. So is Peeta. It's clear he's been waiting for me to wake up to eat and is eager to get started. There's not much left. 2 pieces of grusling, a small mishmash of roots, and a handful of dried fruit.
Should we try and ration it? Peeta asks.
No, let's just finish it. The grusling's getting old anyway, and the last thing we need is to get sick off spoiled food. I say, dividing the food into 2 equal piles. We try and eat slowly, but we're both so hungry we're done in a couple of minutes. My stomach is in no way satisfied.
Tomorrow's a hunting day, I say.
I won't be much help with that, Peeta says. I've never hunted before.
I'll kill and you cook, I say. And you can always gather.
I wish there was some sort of bread bush out there, says Peeta. The bread they sent me from District 11 was still warm, I say with a sigh.
Here, chew these.
I hand him a couple of mint leaves and pop a few in my own mouth. It's hard to even see the projection in the sky, but it's clear enough to know that there were no more deaths today. so Cato and Thresh haven't had it out yet.
Where did Thresh go? I mean, what's on the far side of the circle? I ask Peeta.
A field? As far as you can see, it's full of grasses as high as my shoulders. I don't know. Maybe some of them are grain. There are patches of different colors. But there are no paths, says Peeta.
I bet some of them are grain. I bet Thresh knows which ones, too, I say.
Did you go in there? No, nobody really wanted to track Thresh down in that grass. It has a sinister feeling to it. Every time I look at that field, all I can think of are hidden things, snakes and rabid animals and quicksand, Peeta says. There could be anything in there.
I don't say so, but Peeta's words remind me of the warnings they give us about not going beyond the fence in District 12. I can't help for a moment comparing him with Gale, who would see that field as a potential source of food as well as a threat. Thresh certainly did. It's not that Peeta's soft, exactly, and he's proved he's not a coward, but there are things you don't question too much, I guess, when your home always smells like baking bread, whereas Gale questions everything. What would Peeta think of the irreverent banter that passes between us as we break the law each day? Would it shock him, the things we say about Panem? Gale's tirades against the capital?
Maybe there is a bread bush in that field, I say. Maybe that's why Thresh looks better fed now than when we started the games.
Either that or he's got very generous sponsors, says Peeta. I wonder what we'd have to do to get Haymitch to send us some bread.
I raise my eyebrows before I remember he doesn't know about the message Haymitch sent us a couple of nights ago. One kiss equals one pot of broth. It's not the sort of thing I can blurt out, either. To say my thoughts out loud would be tipping off the audience that the romance has been fabricated to play on their sympathies, and that would result in no food at all. Somehow, believably, I've got to get things back on track. Something simple to start with. I reach out and take his hand.
Well, he probably used up a lot of resources helping me knock you out, I say mischievously.
Yeah, about that, says Peeta, entwining his fingers in mine. Don't try something like that again.
Or what?
I ask.
Or...
He can't think of anything good.
Just give me a minute.
What's the problem? I say with a grin.
The problem is we're both still alive, which only reinforces the idea in your mind that you did the right thing, says Peeta.
I did do the right thing, I say.
No, just don't, Katniss.
His grip tightens, hurting my hand, and there's real anger in his voice.
Don't die for me. You won't be doing me any favors, all right?
I'm startled by his intensity, but recognize an excellent opportunity for getting food, so I try to keep up.
Maybe I did it for myself, Peeta. Did you ever think of that? Maybe you aren't the only one who worries about what it would be like if...
I fumble. I'm not as smooth with words as Peeta.
And while I'm talking, the idea of actually losing Peeta hit me again, and I realized how much I don't want him to die.
And it's not about the sponsors. And it's not about what will happen back home. And it's not just that I don't want to be alone. It's him. I do not want to lose the boy with the bread.
If what, Katniss? He says softly.
I wish I could pull the shutters closed, blocking out this moment from the prying eyes of Panem. Even if it means losing food, whatever I'm feeling, it's no one's business but mine.
That's exactly the kind of topic Haymitch told me to steer clear of, I say evasively,
although Haymitch never said anything of the kind. In fact, he's probably cursing me out right now for dropping the ball during such an emotionally charged moment. But Peeta somehow catches it.
Then I'll just have to fill in the blanks myself, he says,
and moves into me. This is the first kiss that we're both fully aware of, neither of us hobbled by sickness or pain or simply unconscious, our lips neither burning with fever or icy cold. This is the first kiss where I actually feel stirring inside my chest, warm and curious. This is the first kiss that makes me want another. But I don't get it. Well, I do get a second kiss, but it's just a light one on the tip of my nose because Peter's been distracted. I think your wound is bleeding again. Come on, lie down. It's bedtime anyway, he says. My socks are dry enough to wear now. I make Peter put his jacket back on. The damp cold seems to cut right down to my bones, so he must be half frozen. I insist on taking the first watch, too, although neither of us think it's likely anyone will come in this weather. But he won't agree unless I'm in the bag, too, and I'm shivering so hard that it is pointless to object. In stark contrast to 2 nights ago, when I felt Peter was a million miles away, I'm struck by his immediacy now. As we settle in, he pulls my head down to use his arm as a pillow. The other rests protectively over me even when he goes to sleep. No one has held me like this in such a long time. Since my father died and I stopped trusting my mother, no one else's arms have made me feel this safe. With the aid of the glasses, I lie watching the drips of water splatter on the cave floor, rhythmic and lulling. Several times I drift off briefly and then snap awake, guilty and angry with myself. After 3 or 4 hours, I can't help it. I have to rouse Peter because I can't keep my eyes open. He doesn't seem to mind. Tomorrow, when it's dry, I'll find us a place so high in the trees we can both sleep in peace. I promise, as I drift off. But tomorrow is no better in terms of weather. The deluge continues as if the game makers are intent on washing us all away. The thunder so powerful it seems to shake the ground. Peter's considering heading out anyway to scavenge for food, but I tell him in this storm it would be pointless. He won't be able to see 3 feet in front of his face, and he'll only end up getting soaked to the skin for his troubles. He knows I'm right, but the gnawing in our stomachs is becoming painful. The day drags on, turning into evening, and there's no break in the weather. Hamish is our only hope, but nothing is forthcoming. Either from lack of money, everything will cost an exorbitant amount, or because he's dissatisfied with our performance. Probably the latter. I'd be the first to admit we're not exactly riveting today. Starving, weak from injuries, trying not to reopen wounds. We're sitting huddled together, wrapped in the sleeping bag, yes, but mostly to keep warm. The most exciting thing either of us does is nap. I'm not really sure how to ramp up the romance. The kiss last night was nice, but working up to another will take some forethought. There are girls in the seam, some of the merchant girls, too, who navigate these waters so easily, but I've never had much time or use for it. Anyway, just a kiss isn't enough anymore, clearly, because if it was, we'd have gotten food last night. My instincts tell me Hamish isn't just looking for physical affection. He wants something more personal, the sort of stuff he was trying to get me to tell about myself when we were practicing for the interview. I'm rotten at it, but Peter's not. Maybe the best approach is to get him talking. Peter, I say lightly. You said at the interview you'd had a crush on me forever. When did forever start?
Oh, let's see. I guess the first day of school. We were 5. You had on a red plaid dress, and your hair? It was in 2 braids instead of 1. My father pointed you out when we were waiting to line up, Peter says.
Your father? Why? I ask.
He said, see that little girl? I wanted to marry her mother, but she ran off with a coal miner, Peter says.
What? You're making that up, I exclaim.
No, true story, Peter says. And I said, a coal miner? Why did she want a coal miner if she could have had you?
And he said, because when he sings, even the birds stop to listen. That's true. They do. I mean,